Hi, this is Joel Haber, and my favorite thing is the Shabbat stew.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. This week, we are revisiting a conversation I had with Joel Haber, who is a food historian in Israel and tour guide, that I had with him in the fall of 2022. So not my most recent trip to Israel, but the first kind of post-COVID, post-cancer trip that I took. I am bringing this episode back this week because this weekend has been the worst terrorist attack in Israel since I've been going. I've been going since 2006. I've been going on an almost annual basis to Israel. But it's the worst attack since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. It was the most Jews who have been murdered in one day since the end of the Holocaust. This attack by Hamas in Israel over what are some of our most joyous holidays, over Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, where we celebrate finishing reading the Torah and we start again and we dance and we celebrate. This is such a horrific act of terrorism and war. And I've been online trying to follow it, but without what had once been a very carefully curated feed of Israelis and news reporters on Twitter, it's much harder to follow than it once was. At first, it seemed like my friends weren't getting called up into reserves, but friends are starting to get called into reserves. Friends' parents are getting called into reserves. Friends' children are already in the army. This attack by Hamas was brutal. And I think you can hold two truths at once, which is that Hamas is a terrorist organization that brutally attacked civilians, both Israeli and non-Israeli people were murdered. Women have been raped. Elderly and children have been kidnapped. This brutal attack is inhumane. And also it can be true that the occupation of Palestine is inhumane. Neither justifies the other. And it's all nuance is going to collapse in the coming weeks, in the coming hours, when it comes to Israel's and Israelis' right to defend themselves and the desire of most people in the region for peace, despite what their extremist governments are searching for. And I'm so sad. I'm so scared. There's not another country where I have more friends concentrate. It's such a small country. And because of Twitter and the Schusterman Foundation and the Wexner Foundation and the work I've done in the Jewish world since I converted, I have so many friends there. And they're so scared right now. And it's so awful. But I thought it would be nice to revisit this episode with Joel Haber. We're talking about Shabbat stews and the history of Jewish food in the region. And I guess I also didn't really think it was fair to put a sad introduction about Israel and this new war, this continuation of a war, in front of an interview with somebody who is not Jewish, not connected to the conflict, not connected to the region, but I also didn't think I couldn't skip over what happened this weekend. It's also a 3-day holiday, so there are so many observant Jews in America who still don't know what's happening. And when the sun goes down tonight, their phones are going to light up and they're going to find out that horrible things have been happening while they were celebrating Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah. So I really am so scared of what's to come and so hopeful for an immediate ceasefire and the return of the kidnapped, and the return of the bodies of the people who are dead. And that whether they're friend or stranger, that people stay safe in this. So, you know, the American Friends of Magen David, my friends at Friday Night Movie have been posting about donating there. That's the red, kind of like the Red Cross of Israel. So I'll be making a donation there to the American Friends of the Red of Magen David, Magen David. I'll share a link to that. And I don't know, COVID boosters are available now, and I've got to get that on my calendar. So wear your mask, wash your hands, stay safe. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. I am not in my living room. I am not on a Zoom call. I am, in fact, in a hotel room high above Jerusalem with my friend Joel Haber. Joel is a tour guide and specifically a food tour guide in Jerusalem. His website is tasteofjew.com. And I'm so pleased to be with you today. How are you, Joel?
I'm doing great. So really happy to be with you as well.
It's good to see you back here
in the Holy Land.
It's good to be back.
Yeah.
It's good to be back. Last night we met up, as we often do when I'm on a trip, for a Motzei Shabbat outing.
Indeed. That was good.
It was good. And we went to Burger Barn. Not barn. Bar.
Right.
There are no barns in Israel. What am I saying?
Of course there are, on all the kibbutzim and stuff, you know. Yeah, it's not the best burger in Israel, but it was the most available one at the time.
It was most available.
We were bad.
Yeah. And then we had then we went around the corner for drinks. What was the bar we went to? Red Bird?
The Red Lady.
The Red Lady.
Yeah, so we'll give them a nice shout out.
Yeah, so we went to the Red Lady.
And
I had
you
this
had
beautiful
cocktails.
Cocktail that was like a bourbon and Hennessy and maple. It was almost like a Manhattan, Manhattan.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. And then I had a delicious gin and tonic.
And I stuck with the standard Guinness.
Yes. But like a surprisingly, not surprisingly, you know them, you know they have a good pour, but like a really good pour of a Guinness.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're a nice new-ish bar here in Jerusalem. They opened like either right before Corona or during. And so, you know, they survived and they're doing all right.
Yeah, that felt weird. So, Joel, we've known each other. I think we met for the first time before you moved to Israel.
I'm not sure. I don't think so, because I think we met via Twitter and I didn't do it much before I came here.
So, right.
It could be. You may be right.
So you won't remember. I believe you were on like your grand tour before you moved to Israel.
Okay.
And you were having a bar night in New York.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Because didn't you? You were in LA.
That was like literally the night before I moved
yes.
to Israel.
And I was somehow in New York with Esther Kustanowitz.
Okay.
And believe we dropped by. And she's like, it's this guy, Joel, fun Joel. You'll get to know him.
I believe you. It's not surprising I don't remember much of that night.
Right. So that was your...
And it was also like the night before St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. That all makes sense.
So, yeah. So, but okay, cool.
Yeah.
So just before I moved
just
to Israel.
Literally just before. But we make a point of seeing each other every time I'm here.
And it's great. I'm happy to see you back here.
It's so good to be out here. So what keeps you busy?
So as you mentioned, I'm a tour guide, a licensed tour guide here in Israel, and I guide all over the place. But one of my very popular tours that I do, that I've done for many years now, is a culinary tasting tour in Machane Yehuda Market. That's the main outdoor food market here in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And out of that developed, as I would research the food that I was guiding and things like that, so it opened up this whole world for me of Jewish food history.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wouldn't say I was friends, but I personally knew Gil Marks, who's was one of the great Jewish food writers of the last few decades, and unfortunately he passed away very, you know, much too young.
Mm.
But he was always very open to answer questions, and at that point I didn't necessarily think that this was going to become an avocation of mine, but he was... Definitely, if I had questions, he would always answer them, and very, very encouraging. And so he was also an inspiration on that front. And so what that led to is now I also research and write and lecture about Jewish food history.
Amazing. Yeah, because after I'd been to Israel a few times, I was like, oh, I'm getting too comfortable just in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and I don't do anything new anymore. And so there were two trips when I hired you to like take me on tours. We did one that was like Old City and the Israel Museum one day,
mm-hmm.
which was amazing because we would go on top of a building and then you would pull out a copy of like the Torah and you'd be like, okay, this verse, this chapter, this verse, this is where we're standing.
Something
and it was
like
great.
Yeah. And then did we go to Caesarea?
We did.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah.
That was the first time I ever rented a car in Israel.
Right.
Because legally, tour guides aren't drivers, right?
You need another license if you're also going to drive, which I don't have and I don't necessarily want.
Right. So I was driving, you were navigating, and we went to Caesarea, and I feel like we went to...
Maybe a winery?
A winery, yeah. It was a super fun day.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I feel like it was after then that the food tours really started to pick up for you.
I mean, they certainly have increased over the years, but I was certainly doing them back then. And, you know, last year, I guess, maybe about a year, more than that, a little over a year ago, probably a year and a half ago or a quarter ago, I was trying to figure out how many people I've actually guided in the market itself.
Oh, wow.
And I don't remember the number now, but it's somewhere over 3,000 people that I've taken just in the market, which blows my mind.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you remember every single one of them?
Of course. Of course.
I think you have a better face for names than I do.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Maybe. A face for names or
a brain for faces?
Names? Yeah.
A face for names.
Whatever.
It works.
Yeah.
It works.
I'm not as good as it with it as I was when I was a lot younger. Mm-hmm. But
you also know more people than almost anyone I know.
I do know a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's my mom used to say that I collect people.
You do.
So yeah.
You do.
I like people. They're good.
Yeah. And when people are coming to Jerusalem for the first time, let's say they've got 24 hours to eat in Jerusalem, not on Shabbat. What are the like either can't miss meals? If you were doing Joel's 24 hours of food outside of your apartment, because I know you're a good cook, what would you have people eat?
So I am not a one size fits all kind of a person. So whenever people ask me, I always start with, what kind of food do you like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you in the mood for?
Right.
Because there's a lot of good things. Frankly, like, I don't know if there's that many things that are like, this is awesome. You have to try it. There are a few things like that.
Yeah.
But like, really, I try to tailor to what people like. So, you know, if somebody is more into like the Middle Eastern thing, I might send them somewhere. If somebody else is looking for more modernist type stuff, I might send them somewhere else. Are they looking for street foodie type stuff, or are they looking for more upscale?
Let's say
it's a hard question for me to answer.
It's a street food
likes to party person?
I might send them, first of all, to Ishtabach.
Okay.
Have you been to Ishtabach?
I don't think so.
So Ishtabach is 2 blocks from the Shuk.
Okay.
It is, they basically make one main dish that was invented here in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a local Jewish Jerusalem food.
All right.
Invented by a member of the local Syrian Kurdish Jewish community as a way of repurposing the leftovers from Shabbat. Obviously, in the restaurant, they're not using leftovers, but that's the idea of it.
Sure.
So it's basically like a flat disc of really good bread dough with sesame seeds and nigella seeds on it.
Mm.
On top of that goes a really good mashed potato.
Okay.
On top of that goes meat. Got about 10 different options there, or even a vegetarian option. On top of that goes a nice flavorful vegetable topping. Twist the end, stick it into a brick oven for about 10, 12 minutes. When it comes out, it's crispy, it's filling, it's delicious. And not expensive, costs around 50 shekels, which is, I guess, about 15 bucks these days, something like that. And the name of the dish, Shamburak, is a play on words, as is the name of the restaurant. The name of the restaurant is a pun on a prayer.
Okay.
Yishtabach means he is praised, like God is praised.
Yishtabach, Ish, okay, right?
And then Ishtabach means cook man. and the name of the dish, Shamburak, is spelled with the same letters as the word shemivorach, that is blessed, because it's the food from Shabbat, from Sabbath.
Nice.
And it's really special, really yummy dish.
It sounds like a cross between shepherd's pie and a calzone.
Yeah, so those are definitely things that are related. So they do, for those who are gluten-free, they do make a shepherd's pie version of the same thing.
Oh, okay.
So they'll put the same stuff just without the dough. They'll put it into like a, I guess,
like a crock or something.
Yeah, something like that. And I often say it's like a meat calzone, but the dough is so much better than calzone dough.
Sure.
Like calzone dough is nice. This is what's good about this is that instead of being chewy, it's crispy, but it's yummy. So, yeah. But there are similarities for sure. And the shape of it. Do you know Khachapuri? Do you know what Khachapuri are?
No.
So that's another great place for dairy food in Jerusalem, Khachapuria. Yeah. So Khachapuri is a collective term for a number of different regional dishes in Georgia. The country, not the state.
Yep.
It's not Rococo casserole. And basically,
the word we use is peaches.
So Khachapuri means cheese bread. So
all the things combined cheese and bread. I'm into it.
But the most famous Khachapuri that most people know, some people only know that one, is called Ajaruli. And it's basically like a boat shaped bread.
Yes.
And then the middle is open, and inside it has melted cheese, and you pop an egg in there, and there's butter and whatever.
I've seen that,
Yeah. So this is the same shape. It's like kind of pointed like at the ends with an opening in the middle. Yeah.
All right. That sounds amazing.
Except it's not going to be runny because it's meat.
Yeah. Right. And what about, so Red Lady.
The Red Lady, yeah.
The Red Lady is where we went last night. What are other good, so you mentioned, you said, are you, and if you want beer, we'll go to like
Birreno? Yeah, there's a place called Birateno.
Birateno.
Which, I'm sorry to say once again, is a pun. Because Birateno means our beer.
Yeah.
But also the word for a capital, like the capital city which we're in, is Ir Habira.
Okay.
So you could say Ir Habira, which means like the capital city. Or you could say Ir Habira, like the beer city. So it's also our capital and also our beer.
Our beer. Okay.
So they're a local bar / pub / bottle shop / homebrew supply store.
Nice.
They're focused on craft beers, not only Israeli craft beers, although they have a lot of those. And also lots of other craft beers from around the world. And they have other things to eat and drink as well. And so that's a fun place that I hang out a lot.
Nice. It sounds like
a lot.
There's a place in Chicago called Beer Miscuous.
I have a t-shirt from them.
Oh, how funny.
I guided somebody who used to be their manager. I mean, he was the manager at the time. I don't know. Maybe you sent them to me for all I know. But some guy like hired me for a tour once. And at the end of the tour, like 2 days or something like that, at the end of the tour, he's like, I know you like beer. And he gave me the t-shirt.
Oh my gosh.
So I wear it around.
I love that.
He doesn't work there anymore though.
Okay. But Beer Miscuous is, you go in and it's just walls and walls of craft beer and incredible things on tap.
And I like that they refer to it as a craft beer cafe.
Yes.
Not a craft beer bar.
Yeah. And so you go, I've gone once, a friend of mine has a business called Magic by the Slice, where he does close-up magic and deep dish pizza. So he comes to your house, he bakes deep dish pizza like in your kitchen. So he
magically
magically And then while it's in the oven, he does close-up magic.
That's awesome.
It's amazing. And so once I went to a fundraiser that he was the entertainment for at Beermiscuous.
Cool.
Because they don't, I don't think they have a kitchen. So you bring in your own food, you buy their beer, magic.
Awesome.
It was so fun. But yeah.
Yeah. If and when I get to Chicago, I will definitely have to check them out.
Yes. And high on your list.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I'll wear my shirt.
That would be so funny.
They'll think that like I've been there before. But, and be like, right. No.
Nope. Just a first timer here from Jerusalem.
There you go.
First time caller, long time t-shirt drinker. Wear. Drinker. Awesome. So Joel, you know, the podcast, I talk to people about their favorite thing, and one of your favorite things lately is Shabbat stews.
Yes.
I only know cholent, which is a beany, meaty stew.
Sure.
I don't know much about Shabbat stews.
Right.
So,
yeah, maybe I should first like even describe what I mean by the term.
Yeah.
So first of all, the term is not like a standard. It's a term that I'm using.
Mm-hmm.
To collectively refer to a lot of dishes. Basically, most Jewish communities from all over the world throughout history have some kind of a multi-ingredient stew, although it's not always a stew. It's not always very stew-like. Sometimes it's a bit drier. But that is prepared on Friday and then cooks through the whole night, Friday night, to be eaten for lunch on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this, for those who don't know, but the reason for it is that it solves a contradiction, two things that don't work together.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that according to traditional Jewish law, it is forbidden to cook actively on the Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
meaning from Friday night until Saturday night. But at the same time, because you're supposed to have your best food and things like that on Shabbat, you want to have hot food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Friday night, that's easy. You just cook something and
right up until the
Yeah, and then like, okay, it'll still be pretty hot or at least warm. But what do you do for Shabbat day? And so since ancient times, literally, Jews have found ways to basically leave something warming through the night on a relatively low flame. So we call it like low and slow.
Mm-hmm.
And then eat it on Shabbat day for lunch.
Yeah.
Now, the cholent that you mentioned is perhaps the most familiar to, let's say, American Jews, because it is Eastern European Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
But in fact, there are many different ones from around the world that have different ingredients, different names, and yet all of them are prepared on Friday, left to cook through the night, and eaten for lunch on Shabbat day.
Yeah.
And so to me, I view them as all versions of the same dish rather than different dishes. And the way I collectively refer to them, because you need some way to talk about them all, is a Shabbat stew.
Yeah. So I'm curious, growing up, were you in like a cholent community? And like, did you know about anything other than cholent before you got to Israel?
Before I got to Israel, yes. But growing up, no. I mean, my mom would make cholent.
Yeah.
And her parents were from, you know, Poland and Austria, mm-hmm. et cetera, or Galicia. Which is southeastern Poland. Depending on when you look at it, it could be Poland, could be Austria, could be Ukraine.
Yes.
And she would make kind of what I would call like the standard Ashkenazi cholent. Ashkenazi Jews
Which
being those of Central and Eastern Europe.
Is it a meaty beany
dish? Yeah. So basically, the core. the standard ingredients would be beans, barley, potatoes, onions, meat.
Okay.
And then, you know, water and salt and stuff like that. But those are the core ingredients. There will be many variations, but that's the core of it.
And you need things that can stand up to heat. I mean,
exactly.
Most people listening will have had cooked something in a crock pot. Cooked it too long, cooked it too, like, at least people listening, if they haven't made cholent, have made something low and slow in the crock pot before.
Probably.
But you need things that are.
But few people have probably left in the crock pot for 15 hours.
Right. on purpose, no.
Right. And
yeah.
So that's the thing, is that people, like, you have to look at this dish and say, who thought of that?
Right.
Who thought that would be a good idea? And obviously, it grew out of necessity. They say necessity is the mother of invention. And it was. And amazingly, it's actually really good.
Yeah.
It actually gives, like, people can make cholent or other Shabbat stews and cook them for fewer hours. Like, for example, in the late 1800s, when Germany, German Jews, after they'd been emancipated, they started getting really secular.
Yeah.
A lot of people, even when you when your religious views change, your stomach doesn't.
Your stomach doesn't. Yeah.
And so they would still cook cholent for them it would be shallot. They would still cook their shallot because they liked it, but they would cook it for like 2 hours or 3 hours and eat it on Friday night. And it does not have the same taste. I've eaten many times my cholent, you know, even though I'm cooking it overnight. Midnight, on Friday night, I'll take a little sample because I'm hungry. It's good, but it's not the same thing.
Right. Now, are you starting... So you've been collecting recipes, but does this basic Ashkenazi cholent, are you starting with like soaked beans? Are you starting with canned beans? Like, I imagine you're starting with dry beans that maybe you soaked because, again, you want things to be able to stand up to 15 hours of heat.
Right. So I guess traditionally it would be dried beans that you'd soak overnight. Frankly, and I'm sure there will be people that will be, you know, like think that I'm mad, but I use canned beans. I don't notice a difference in taste.
Okay.
In a dish like this, you know, like when you're eating like a dish where beans are forefronted, you might want something better. I use canned beans all the time.
Okay.
I don't think anybody tastes a difference. And frankly, I wouldn't recommend it, but I know people that have like not had the time or forgot to soak their dried beans and put them in. And after all that time cooking, they're still pretty fine, you know?
Okay. Nice.
But it's not just for the Ashkenazi. Like most of these Shabbat Jews, not all of them, but most of them will have beans of some kind, or many of them will. But what you mentioned before about the idea of needing things that can stand up to the long cooking is definitely a thing, because...
Right.
I'm very much in cooking in general, and especially with something like this that has been around for thousands of, you know, for maybe not thousands, maybe about 1500 years or so. And has changed and transformed over time. Everybody should feel free to experiment and do what they like.
Absolutely.
If they're like, oh, I don't like this ingredient, can I leave it out? Of course, leave it out. Your grandma
your
left
house.
It out, you know?
It's your house,
So it's not a delicate dish.
Right.
So I say, you know, try it. And when people say, oh, will this work? I might say to them, look, it sounds like that's going to get mushy inside. You might not like it, but give it a try once.
Yeah.
Worst comes to worst, you won't do it again.
Yeah. And what is the cut of, because I also imagine you're getting a beef cut that's like not, you're, I really have become in the last few years a huge fan of chicken thighs.
Mm-hmm.
Where were they my whole life? I don't know. I have learned that they are like
the
best.
They were on the chickens.
They were on the chickens. Like, as easy to eat as a drumstick, but way more meat.
Yeah.
I love a chicken thigh. But a chicken thigh for 15 hours.
There are plenty of overnight Shabbat stews that use chicken.
Really?
Really.
Okay, not just, like, tough beef cuts.
Nope.
Huh.
So one of the things that I uncovered in my research, so you mentioned the book, so, like, just to give the quick background, what I'm not making a cookbook, although I am doing a little mini cookbook that I'm going to release soon as like a little promotion, an e-cookbook. But the book is a book of food writing, food history writing, where basically I am looking at these different Shabbat stews from all around the world. And since I view them as different versions of the same dish, I use them as a way of tracing the routes of our migration through the diaspora. Mm-hmm. How did we get from place to place? When did we move there? What were the different scenarios? And therefore, how did the dish change in each place? And why did it change that way? So, when I look at those different stews from around the world, I see that there's a certain breakdown of ingredients. So, for example, with the meat, none of this is 100% cut and dry. There's always exceptions.
Sure.
But by and large, chicken is the primary meat in Asia.
Okay.
Lamb would be the primary meat in Africa, and beef the primary meat in Europe.
Okay.
Okay. Grains. So rice would be the primary grain in Asia, wheat in Africa. And when I say Africa, I mean North Africa and barley in Europe.
Okay.
There's always exceptions to these. I don't mean this to be universal, but if you were to
generalities.
On average. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. But really, I think that we can trace them all back to the same core dish, which is a dish that's ancient. Literally ancient, called harissa, not the spicy paste from North Africa.
Okay.
Same name, different dish.
Okay.
And harissa is basically wheat and lamb originally, maybe some onions. That's it. And it cooked like a porridgey consistency, and then you sort of beat it.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes a real porridge. And then it would be served with extra fat drizzled on top and some cinnamon, and that's pretty much it. a really basic dish. The Jewish version of harissa was mm-hmm. recognized as different than the Arab version of harissa because mm-hmm. it started in the Middle East. That's why mm-hmm. I said the Jewish and the Arab. Although its precursors are before there were Jews or Arabs, by sure. the way. Okay. It was recognized as a different dish, and we know that in modern times there are still Jews who cook what they call harissa, which is a similar version of this, mm-hmm. as their Shabbat stew. Mm. So one of the most logical explanations is what made the Jewish version different. There's mm-hmm. a few things that could have made it different, but one of them most likely is that they used it as a Shabbat stew overnight cooking.
Right. So they wouldn't have done the final pounding.
They might have.
Yeah.
Like that's not, it depends on who you ask whether that's permissible on Shabbat okay. or not, but that's not a core element of the recipe, okay. I would say. But
okay.
although the name harissa actually comes from that step. It means like pounded. Yeah. But, huh. But yeah, it's possible. There's in modern times, there were definitely, I've read about, I think maybe in Claudia Roden, I can't remember. I've read about that in Iraq, Jews would have like a Shabbat goy, meaning, you know, somebody who was not Jewish who mm-hmm. might work in their house doing stuff, and they would have them pound it for them
okay.
on Shabbat.
Okay.
But
so you said that, you know, growing up, you were from a cholent house, a cholent community.
Right. So my mom would cook cholent, but I will say to her credit, she would make it even though she doesn't like it, she doesn't eat it.
Okay. Okay. But then as an adult, before you came to Israel, you started learning about other Shabbat stews.
Sure.
So can you remember the first time you went to somebody's house for Shabbat and there was a stew that you hadn't, that was like so different and you're like, ooh, I gotta know more about this?
No, because what I've seen in America,
uh-huh.
And it's logical understanding the American community and modern times, and it is a modern Jewish community, mm-hmm. is the there's first of all there's a bleeding of cultures together, of
yeah.
course. I think that's I don't want to say exacerbated because that usually has a bad connotation, but increased, I guess, mm-hmm. by the number of people who have converted to mm-hmm. Judaism or who have become observant, who didn't grow up observant,
sure.
and therefore didn't have their own Shabbat stews growing up,
mm-hmm.
and then wanted to make one, and so they'll pick and choose as they like. So
yeah.
you have this big mixing of different cultures.
Yeah.
And also, you know, who was it? Thomas Friedman said the world is flat. I think it was Thomas Friedman. It's the name of a book.
Yeah.
You know, in the digital age, the world is flat. So anybody who wants to make anything can just go online. So lots of people will do things. And so instead of having like a strictly different version of the Shabbat mm-hmm. stew, you know, you might find one that just has like the influences. They're like, oh yeah, well, I like putting, you know, sweet potatoes and mm-hmm. carrots into my cholent, even though that might be more common in North Africa.
Okay.
Or something of that nature.
Yeah.
So I don't remember distinctively the first time I had one that was completely different.
Okay.
But certainly I would see the influences, you know, or somebody who's putting in different spices mm-hmm. or dates or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Dates?
Yeah.
In a hot.
Yeah, it just, they'll often dissolve, but it'll give it a little sweetness in
okay.
there. But yeah.
Okay. That makes more sense.
It's common in Moroccan
yeah.
Dafina or Skhina, depending
yeah.
on, yeah.
I guess it's sort of like semis, right?
Well, you wouldn't have that many dates in there, so it wouldn't be, it's not primarily
yeah.
dried fruits. They're just in there.
Okay.
As flavorings.
Okay. So like a couple bay leaves, a couple dates.
I don't know if I've ever seen bay leaves in there, but it could be, yeah.
Okay.
And then you can go, interestingly, since we're talking about the dried fruits,
yeah.
you go to Bukhara, which is Uzbekistan, Central uh-huh. Asia. And their Shabbat stew, which is called osavo,
mm-hmm.
Also has dried fruits, so although not the same kind. They'll have things like dried apricots or dried prunes in there and grated green apple. They do like a sweet and sour
Ooh.
Stew. Yeah, it's actually really yummy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you had that here or there?
Here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's you know, it's interesting. And one of the things that I love most about this dish mm-hmm. is that like, you know, when we look at Jewish food, and that could mean so many things.
Yeah.
And people sometimes will like almost make a demand of like indigeneity
mm-hmm.
and uniqueness, that like it needs to be a food that you invented and that only you eat, which mm-hmm. I think is ridiculous. But
it's hard to get there. Yeah.
In any yeah. cuisine.
Yeah.
But despite that, there are certain foods that meet that characteristic for us. I mm-hmm. think the most obvious one is matzah.
Yes.
Okay. It grows. It's in the Torah. It grows out of our tradition, mm-hmm. out of our history.
Yep.
And pretty much nobody else eats it.
No.
Because you'd be crazy to.
Not
exactly.
On purpose.
Right? So that's
occasionally
an example.
You'll see people in Chicago who are like, what a deal on giant saltine crackers.
Exactly.
And then I just imagine, you know, so they buy like the six pack. It's, you know, it's marked down after Passover. So it's like so cheap.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh.
Although I was a month or two, I don't know, like 2 months ago, I think it was. So it was in the summer already. I was up in the Golan Heights with a tour group. Yeah. And I went into a supermarket in a Druze village. The entire village is Druze, mm-hmm. not Jews, Druze, not Jews.
D-R-U-Z-E.
Correct.
Yes.
And they had matzah for sale, which means these people eat it.
Yeah.
In the summer, not in Pesach.
Right.
Yeah, Passover. Yeah. Anyway, what was I saying?
Salty, sweet.
Oh, right. So yeah, I was saying that the matzah is an example of a food that is unique and indigenous to us. And I believe that the Shabbat stew is as well. It's another example of that. So it's not only something that would be hard to argue is not a Jewish food.
Right.
And on top of that, I think that it's in many ways the most Jewish food. Matzah we eat 1 week a year. This we eat every week.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, as I'm arguing in my book, it really follows our or accompanied us on our diasporic wanderings, it embodies the Jewish experience.
Interesting.
So to me, that's what's fascinating to me about this dish. I think you can look at this dish and see the Jewish people.
Yeah. So as you've been collecting recipes, testing recipes, hosting people for Shabbat and introducing them to new Shabbat stews, is there a diasporic path, maybe, that is people, like, what's the stew that surprises people that they're like, whoa? Or is it that your guests in Israel have had it? Like, what? Okay, let me take this back.
Okay.
What would surprise me? Not your normal guests who come over all the time, but like me who's had cholent once.
Right. So when I serve the things, I don't always, I'm not, you know, like a professor or something. So I don't sit at the meal and describe to them how it got there. So I can read the book for that.
Right.
But often like just
the taste
or things. So I think one of the ones that has been a hit in most times I've served it and people really like it. And it's recognizable, but different enough. So in India, there are three distinct Jewish communities.
Okay.
Or five, depending on how you're defining your terms. Mm-hmm. But let's say three.
Yeah.
Okay. One of them, the most modern of those three, is the Baghdadi Jews of Iraq, who moved there starting in the late 1700s.
Okay.
And so they certainly have influences from Iraq, but they also have the influences in India of like different spices and things like that. So I have a recipe for an Indian, Baghdadi Indian khamin.
Okay.
Khamin is another term for this stew. It's it's kind of the most, just like cholent is the most common generic term for it in America, khamin would be the most generic term for it here in Israel.
Okay.
And it's made with rice and chicken and some really nice spices that give it a real aromatic flavor in the rice. Mm-hmm. But what also makes it really Indian is that it's served with this chutney of cilantro and ginger and lemon and a little bit of garlic. And I like take that and I just kind of stir it through. Like I pull the meat off the bone on the chicken, mix it with the rice, and then stir this chutney through. And it gives this brightness to it in color and in taste.
Yeah.
Because that's not cooked. This chutney's sitting on the side. You know? So people love that one.
That sounds amazing.
It is really good.
That's great. Because we talked about the e-cookbook that you'll be releasing as you help make sure we want to like get all these names. You've toured with 3,000 people through the Shuk. You don't have all their email addresses because you get like the person who organizes the tour, you got them, but not the other 10 people.
Right.
So we want to bring people back through this Shabbat stew cookbook. How long have you been collecting Shabbat stew recipes?
I mean, actively, not that long.
Okay.
Actively, maybe a year or two. I'd say what it started with, as I began to drill down on the research of this topic, was, I'd say about 3 or 4 years ago now, I made like a survey via like, you know, Google, whatever it's called.
Google Forms.
Google Forms. Yeah. That's what I was looking for. That I passed around, where basically I didn't get recipes, but like it had a whole bunch of things like what's the name that you call your Shabbat stew, what are the ingredients, mm-hmm. things like that, where are you from, it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I collected a lot of, I don't remember how many, but it was I got good responses.
Nice.
So that was the beginning of it, and that was about, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago. Actively collecting recipes is probably within the last 2 years.
Yeah.
But like I said, like it's not only about the recipes. That's a big part of it. Like, so the e-cookbook will hopefully be out within the next month. And beyond that, also in the book, although it's not a cookbook, there will be recipes in there.
Yeah.
Because I think people would be upset if there weren't to read all about this food and not be able to cook it. So there's going to be, you know, probably 2 recipes in each chapter plus a few more at the end.
Yeah.
Like in an appendix. So, yeah. So I have been collecting them and testing them. Mm-hmm. And I had a few other people who have helped me to test the recipes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's that. And what will help me to collect more is that the other side project that will maybe be in another month and a half or 2 months is I'm launching a website that's connected with the book, cholentbook.com.
Great.
And one of the big things about that will be that there's the opportunity there for people to upload their own recipes and see everybody else's recipes and hopefully create a community and be the one-stop shop for all things Shabbat stew.
Yeah, that is fantastic. I'm curious, like, do people think having a recipe for this is like antithetical to the stew? Like, are there, you know, I'm sure there are people, like, if you are observant and grow up with this and cook it every week, people just like they know how much to put in, right?
Yeah. But I think that's a legitimate question. Yeah. I mean, and like, I myself was like, why should I put recipes in? You just put all these different ingredients in. Let me just tell you what the ingredients are and you'll do it.
Yeah.
But as I've started to do more, I realize that, first of all, there are differences.
Yeah.
In terms of like certain types of stews do require certain techniques.
Yeah.
So like for the traditional Ashkenazi one that I described before, like when I put that recipe, I basically write, put them all in the pot.
Sure. And,
you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But other ones, there are steps that are involved. And so for that, you would need a recipe. In terms of the quantities, one of the things that I encourage, and I mentioned it before, but I, like, also like in this e-cookbook, like in the introduction or early on, I basically say, like, try it. Don't ask, can I do this? Can I do that?
Yeah.
Try it. You don't like that ingredient? Leave it out.
Leave it out.
You want to see if that ingredient will go well in there? Try it once. Worst comes to worst, it won't be the best Shabbat stew you ever had and you won't do it again.
Right.
You know, like, don't, and I do that all the time with my stews. I'll say, like, oh, let's see what happens if I do this. And I'm always changing stuff. I think, like, one of the recipes that I plan to have in the e-cookbook is one that I invented that's totally, you know, different.
Tell me about it. Or do you want to save it for the e-cookbook?
No, I don't mind talking about it. It's not, like, the most unique recipe in the world. But, like, there's a vegetable that we get here. It does grow in America, but I don't remember ever seeing it in America, called cardoon. Do you know what cardoons are?
No.
It looks like a prehistoric celery. It's like bigger and like kind of a less vibrant green.
Okay.
And it has thorns running down the sides of it.
All right.
It's basically a type of a thistle that's a relative of artichoke, let's say.
All right.
We get it in winter in Israel. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's labor intensive because you have to peel the whole outside of it. But then because it's kind of tough, it holds its form when it cooks for a long time. So I was like, oh, that would be perfect in a Shabbat stew because it doesn't turn mushy.
Yeah.
So I made one with that. I've done it with rice, although I think I'm going to change it to wheat. I think it'll be better with wheat.
Yeah.
And some other things and some, you know, spices. And, you know, that's my wintry, because we only get it in winter. So it's my wintry Israeli invented chameen.
Nice.
You know? So, yeah, but it's just really, really yummy.
Yeah.
What's also interesting, by the way, is when you look at the Shabbat stews from around the world, and the majority of them are coming from what we would call the old world, meaning, you know, Europe, Africa, and Asia, how prominent new world vegetables have become. Meaning, you know, if you know about the Columbian Exchange,
right?
All of these new world foods that came to the old world and also in the opposite direction, old world things that were brought to the new world, but like
corn,
potatoes, sweet corn, I don't see very frequently in Shabbat stews, although it should be. There's no reason why not.
Yeah. But potatoes, never goes away.
Sweet potatoes, tomatoes, and also like beans that are like what we would call common beans. Pretty much all the beans except for like fava beans, chickpeas, mm-hmm. lentils, which are not beans, but
yeah.
those types of, those were the legumes that were used in this area before the Columbian Exchange. White beans, kidney beans, cannellini beans, all of those are all new world foods. And now they're like ubiquitous in Shabbat stews, which is amazing.
Right. Because I haven't thought about, I mean, certainly in Israel, I feel like my friends, the food here is much more seasonal.
Yes.
Than in the U.S.
Yes. It's so, a pleasure.
Yeah.
It could be frustrating when you first move here because, like, I always put those two things together in a salad. We're like, well, sorry, that's in season in March and that's in August. You can't put them together.
You'll never have them together again.
Right.
On Shabbat, they were like, it's lime season. It's the real limes. Squeeze a lime in your seltzer because it's finally lime season. It's the 3 weeks of lime season.
Yeah, although it's gotten a bit better than it used to be. It's gotten a little longer. They're planting more of them, I guess.
Yeah. But that's definitely something that you feel more here. And
that's why I was talking about like the cardoons, because like for me, like if I go to the Shuk now, it is nowhere to be seen.
Right.
It's only in the winter.
Right.
So to me, that's what I'm thinking of. And by the way, I will say in that recipe, and I'll say it now also, is that like since cardoons are probably hard to find in America, although I know that they existed because like they were popular in revolutionary times in America.
Yeah.
But I've used like frozen artichoke bottoms in place of them, and they work just well because they're a very similar flavor also.
Yeah.
They won't get too mushy, those.
Yeah.
So that's like a good replacement for the cardoons. You know?
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's, what is a summer stew, or do you want do you want hot food on Shabbat in the summer here?
I do. Not everybody does. I have a friend, a Moroccan friend, or Moroccan French friend who lives here. And he gave me his recipe for his dafina.
Uh-huh.
But he says we only make it in the wintertime. We don't have it in the summer. I'll eat in the summer, but I understand those who don't. But the first that I'm aware of, I think it's the earliest. Certainly, I know of four cookbooks that have come out, all dedicated to Shabbat stews. Two in Hebrew, two in English.
Okay.
Two in English are smaller books put out by a woman whose last name is Pomerantz, something K. Pomerantz, I forget her first name, or K. something Pomerantz, I forget, I'm sorry. But her book was called, the first one was called Come for Cholent, and the second one is something like Come for More Cholent or something like that.
I forget
the second name of the book. They're nice books.
Yeah.
And then there was two in Hebrew. One by Sherry Ansky was the earliest one, called Chamin.
Mm-hmm.
And then in English, on the English copyright page, it says Cholent, which is interesting that they don't use those. And then there was a woman named Asnat Lester who had one called like Tavshile Shabbat, like Shabbat stews, essentially, something like that. Anyway, in Sherry Ansky's book, which I believe was the first one, I think they came out before the American ones, she was doing fewer of traditional recipes. She was also inventing some of her own, etc. But she had a whole section of summer chamin, which essentially, if you look at it, meant like rice and chicken rather than beef.
Oh.
Which was interesting. Exclusively, but that was what I saw in there. So there are people who will do summer ones.
Right.
I don't think that a lot of the summer vegetables hold up that well, although like I have had ones and I've even used them myself where I might put in like, you know, summer squashes like zucchinis and stuff like that. They do get a little bit mushy, but doesn't mean that you can't have them in there. They don't like absolutely disintegrate.
Yeah.
So.
Because those are, you know, like not on Shabbat, you would just grab a, you know, a blender, a stick blender.
Yeah.
I'm finding the word. I need more coffee. And you would just blend away that mushy squash, you know, and like turn it into a smoother soup altogether.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think of like what I want. Because when I've come here and done like Shabbat lunch with friends, a lot of times it's just like a big chunky salad.
Right.
You know, like avocado and...
Yeah, one that might be lighter. I'm actually probably going to make it this week because I haven't made it yet. From Tunisia, I found recipes actually in Sherry Ansky's book to a fish chamin.
Oh, wow.
Instead of meat.
Okay.
And it's going to be using more like ocean fish, so it's a little bit more meatier fish.
Yeah.
That Seems interesting, and I think it would be, and it's obviously going to be a little bit lighter, I think, so it might be good for a summer. I'm going to try that and see how that comes out for a summer.
Nice.
Thing. Yeah.
What else is there about Shabbat Stews that I have not asked you that you would be so sad? So sad if we didn't talk about.
I don't know if there's any one thing. I mean, I like I said, like for me, the way that they summarize the Jewish experience is fascinating, but I think we just like to eat them just because they taste good.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to focus on that. Is there anything else that's really interesting?
Or another very special recipe or someone who gave you a special recipe that excited to share with people?
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating is how, and it may be less direct in terms of being able to trace the routes of our diaspora, but that stew has arrived in or some of the most far-flung Jewish communities.
Yeah.
I have a friend of Surinamese descent from Suriname.
Okay.
Okay. She's actually from Holland, but her roots go back to Suriname.
Yeah.
And there's an ingredient there called, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce it.
Go for it.
I always ask her how to pronounce it. I think it's called palmtire or palmtire, which is... In English, I think they call it, I forgot what it's called in English, but we can look it up.
Oh, yeah.
But basically, this is a dish that is not exclusively eaten by Jews, but that the Jews make this dish with, it's called pom, because it comes from palm tire, which has this grated palm tire, chicken, and usually citrus, which you need to counteract something in the palm.
Okay.
And then it's sort of cooked almost like a potato kugel.
Oh, okay. So like in a casserole dish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have yet to taste it because it's hard to get that ingredient here.
Yeah.
Her mom came from Holland and brought it, but she was in Tel Aviv. I was here. I didn't get a chance to sample it, but hopefully I will still at one point. But apparently this dish now, because there's a lot of Surinamese who have gone to Holland, is now a street food in Holland as well.
Oh, that's wild. Yeah.
So that's one thing. And I think maybe that's one last thing. Maybe we can end with that, which is very interesting, is the connection between this very Jewish food and non-Jewish foods around it. So I'll give you a few interesting examples.
Yeah.
In Hungary, where the Jewish community basically came of age and was emancipated at the same time that Hungary kind of gained its independence. And so they came of age together.
Yeah.
And therefore the Jews were very integrated into Hungarian society.
Yeah.
Cholet, as it's called there, which is obviously similar to cholent, you hear the way it sounds, but there are its unique elements, is something that Hungarians of all stripes eat and know. You can go to any bar in Hungary and there's a pot of cholet. Although it's made with pork.
Yeah, of course.
But like it is the dish. There are three non-kosher brands of cholet canned in the supermarket.
That's wild.
Okay. And then you might talk about how like Spain.
Yeah.
So the Jews, of course, were there for a very long time. Yeah. And then we had a not so pleasant ending there in 1492.
Yeah.
But many, and this is not from a Jewish perspective, many Spanish culinary historians will look at some of the main dishes there, like cocido madrileño, which again, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing, Madrid cocido, which is like a stew. And they'll say, this looks very much like adafina, which is the stew that was eaten there by the Jews, with the prominent placement of pork. And they said it was likely crypto-Jews who kept cooking their same dish and just stuck a lot of pork in to say, look, I'm a real good Christian.
Yeah. Right.
So that influence on the non-Jewish dish. There are people that look at various slow-cooked stews in France.
Yeah.
Like cassoulet, which is from the south of France. And they'll argue, oh, this was actually the precursor of cholent. In my book, I go into a long explanation of why I don't believe that is the proper influence. And if anything, the influence was in the other direction. Or that they were just both developed separately. Yeah. I don't need to get into that now. It's too long. But the idea of just all of these things where it connects, because this dish has been around forever.
Right.
So I think that's something that's really interesting. And it shows how when you look at Jewish cuisine throughout the world and you look at the various interactions with the non-Jewish dishes that existed alongside the Jewish dishes, it shows our relationship. Sometimes we took a non-Jewish dish and just used it. Sometimes it was not kosher. We would change certain elements to make it acceptable for kosher. Sometimes we had dishes that they adapted and adopted. And that's really what's fascinating, is because we've literally spread all over the world, that the Jews are the most globalized nation in the world. Our cuisines have touched all of the cuisines of the world and have interacted with them in both directions. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating things that there is when we look at Jewish food in general and at the Shabbat stew in particular.
Amazing. Wonderful. So I have an unrelated question.
This 17.
This is primarily for the benefit of Shai Korman and Esther Kastanowitz, who do listen. You had some commentary about Top Gun Maverick and the similarities between the...
So let me start by saying I did enjoy Top Gun Maverick. I have nothing against... Like, I don't think it's a bad movie. I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was great fun.
It's cotton and nostalgic. Candy. It's cotton candy.
But, like, I was just reacting when there was people that were like, this is great. I did not think it was a great movie. It was a good movie. It was fun. Totally fun. But one of the things that I saw that that I felt was, like, made it super derivative, maybe they would say it's an homage, but I thought it was derivative, was, like, the entire final sequence where they're flying to blow up the, you know, the thing in the mountain, right, where they're flying really low and they're being chased by the other planes, and then they got to go up and go down and shoot this one, like, 5 square inch spot and the whole thing and then fly back out. I'm like, that was straight out of the Death Star sequence in the original Star Wars movie. Like, it literally even looked like that. You know, where they got to fly low and fly through the... Okay, it's a canal. In this case, it's not, but there's mountains on both sides.
It's essentially a canal.
Okay? Instead of the X-Wings chasing them, you have other fighter planes chasing them, and he's got to go up, and he's got to hit this tiny spot. It's the same thing. So that's what I saw.
So we were looking...
It doesn't ruin the movie, but I was just like, they could have been at least a little bit more creative.
And so I know that Shai and Esther are both Star Wars aficionados who have... I know Shai saw the movie. I think, I assume Esther did. So that was specifically for them. And anyone else who
didn't
are Star
give a
Wars
spoiler alert.
I'll give a spoiler alert in the intro.
I thought you were going to ask me about that scene where they were sitting down to a Shabbat stew.
Well, yes. Also,
with Val Kilmer.
The Val Kilmer Shabbat stew scene.
Yeah, that was that. That brought tears to my eyes.
If you were in, what's that bar in Star Wars?
Oh, I know what you mean. I forget what it's called, but I definitely know. Like
the cantina.
Right.
What do you think Shabbat stew served at the cantina?
And clearly would be? Paid for in advance before Shabbat, of course.
Obviously, yes.
That's a darned good question. I'm not enough of a Star Wars nerd to even know what foods existed in the Star Wars universe. I'm sure. I know you had your Vulcan speaker. I don't think there's a language from Star Wars that people speak the same way they do with Star Wars. But it would probably have steam or a smoke coming up from it. It would be something that like bubbled and had smoke coming up. It would probably be green, I'm guessing. Maybe it would be... Oh, you know what would be awesome if we could, I'm sure you'd have to shecht it first, but if you could like do like, you know, like Ewok stew.
Where the Ewoks are the meat?
Are the meat, yeah.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that's the best I can think of.
Yeah, there's also those little birds and that when Luke is like off on his island alone, there's little birds.
Oh, I don't remember that at all. Told you, I'm really not that big of a Star Wars geek. I did see them, but you know, it's been a long time. So those were the only animals that I remembered. I mean, at first I was going to make a big faux pas and talk about the giant things from the snow thing, and I was like, oh no, those were like robotic things.
They were robots.
Yeah, you
the
can't
AT-ATs.
Eat those. Yeah, the AT-ATs, exactly. So luckily I caught myself before I made that error, but I cop to it now. And I mean, I wouldn't want to eat like Chewie. You know?
No, yeah. Absolutely not. Absolutely.
He would probably be too chewy. Sorry, I couldn't help it.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Joel, where can people find you on the internet?
So let's see. Tasteofjew.com is my general Jewish food history blog. Soon, cholentbook.com. And for tourism specifically, fjisrael.com for Fun Joel, one of my nicknames. And if they want to email me about food stuff, jewishfoodbook@gmail.com. Very easy to remember.
Amazing. jewishfoodbook@gmail.com.
That is correct.
Great. Well, Joel, thank you so much. This has
my
been a
pleasure.
Delight.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much, and great to see you again.
So good to see you.
Look forward to seeing you back here again soon, and all of your listeners also.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.